years. And as you can see, he said, viewing my vest, she's been welcomed by the clan of Murasi. The old man aimed a squinted eye at me.
That so?
The Komazar's grip on my arm tightened. I looked into the old man's eyes, hoping to convey more with a gaze than my words. It is as your Komazar says. I am a princess, first daughter of Morrigan, and I've run from my countrymen who are your enemy. The Komazar looked sideways at me, a slight smile creasing his eyes.
And your name, girl? The old man asked.
I knew you would come. The voice was as clear as the old man's. I closed my eyes, trying to chase it away, but it only came louder and stronger. Jezelia, the one marked with power, the one marked with hope. I opened my eyes. Everyone stared at me, silent and waiting, their eyes wide with curiosity. Jezelia, I answered. My name is Jezelia. His watery eyes studied me, and then he turned to the others standing behind him.
Jezelia, who has been welcomed by the clan of Murasi, he repeated.
They spoke in hushed tones among themselves. The Komazar leaned close, whispering in my ear,
Well done, princess. A convincing touch.
It was only a clever sham to him, but clearly more to these hillfolk. The old man turned back to us.
Some Thanis to warm you on your way?
He offered. The Komazar forced a weak smile. Even he thought Thanis tasted like sour dirt.
We need to be on our way.
We thank you for your graciousness, I interrupted. We would love some. The Komazar shot me a dark glare, but didn't balk in front of the old man, as I knew he wouldn't. It would never do to have a newcomer embrace the tradition of Venda more than its ruler, no matter how distasteful it was. I lifted the proffered mug to my lips. Yes, sour, moldy dirt, but not half as bad as wiggling white grubs. I drank heartily and handed my mug to the woman who served it, thanking her for her kindness. The Komazar took twice as long to down his. He berated me when I didn't offer a display of the gift at our next stop. You said word passes quickly among the hillfolk. A light touch is better than a heavy-handed performance. Leave them wanting more. He laughed.
Shrewd and calculating. Malik was right.
And he is right about so few things. And so the day went, hamlet after hamlet, the Komazar gaining favor with gifts, sacks of flour and morsels of hope, with me as proof that the enemy was trembling and that the gods were smiling on Venda. Mid-afternoon we rested in a valley while the horses drank from a brook. The wind picked up, and the sky grew dark. I held my cloak close about my shoulders, standing apart from the Komazar and soldiers, and looked out at the vista, a land dusky and barren, washed in the colors of a dark, pebbled river. The day had shown me that Venda was an unforgiving place, and only the hardiest survived here. A remnant may have been spared, but only a chosen faithful few had been led by the gods and the girl Morrigan to a land of plenty. Venda was not that land. It had taken the brunt of the devastation. As we rode, we passed forests of stone, rolling hills with only occasional hints of green, fields of burnt red rock, wind-swept trees twisted into haunting shapes that made them look alive, strips of farmland where small crops were coaxed from hard soil, and distant deadlands where the Komazar said nothing lived or grew, lands as forbidding as Infernatare. And yet there was something compelling about the landscape. All I had seen were people trying to survive, faithful in their own ways, adding a bone at a time to tethers, remembering the sacrifice that put it there and the sacrifices yet to be made. People in barbarian dress, like the clothing I wore now. People who didn't speak in grunts, but in humble notes of gratitude. I knew you would come. The words I had heard still bored into me. A strong gust tore at my clothes, and my hair whipped free of the braid. I pushed the wild strands from my face and stared at the endless landscape and darkening clouds crushing the horizon. With two horses, how far could Rafe and I run? Could we disappear into the emptiness for even a few days? Because 3 days alone with him now seemed like the gift of a lifetime. I'd do anything for it. We'd been apart for too long.
So deep in thought.
I whirled around. I didn't hear you walk up.
Not wise in this wilderness to be so lost in your reflections that you forget your back. The hyenas prowl this late in the day, especially for little morsels like you.
He glanced to where I had been looking, a long horizon and endless dipping hills.
What were you thinking?
He asked. Am I not free to own anything? Not even my thoughts?
No, he answered. Not any more.
And I knew he meant it. He studied my face as if waiting for a lie, waiting for something. I remained silent. Seconds ticked by, and I thought he might strike me. He finally shook his head.
If you need to take care of personal matters, my men and I will turn our backs for a few minutes. I know how your kind are about your privacy. Be quick about it.
I watched him walk off, wondering at how he had backed down, wondering about everything. He had saved Caden, sent food for the hungry, was tireless in knowing his kingdom, from personally retrieving governors to meeting with distant hill folk. Could I have been wrong about him? I remembered his cruel taunt, "You did well, Chievdar," when he pulled Walther's baldric from the captured booty. He knew it would bring me to my knees. But it was more than that that fed my doubts about him. It was his eyes, hungry for everything, even my own thoughts. Be careful, sister. My brother's warning burned beneath my ribs. And yet, when we stopped at the last hamlet, and I saw him embrace the elders and leave gifts, saw the hope that he left behind, and remembered it was he who had saved Caden from the savagery of his own kind, I wondered if anything I felt in my gut really mattered.
And Morrigan raised her voice to the heavens, kissing two fingers, one for the lost, and one for those yet to come, for the winnowing was not over. Morrigan, Book of Holy Text, Volume 4. Chapter 31. Caden.
After 4 days on the road, I decided the gods were against me. Maybe they always had been. No such luck that the governor would be coming my way, half-sloshed and late. The brothel in the last town hadn't had the pleasure of his visit yet, and that was a stop he never missed. He was still somewhere on the road from here to there, or he hadn't left yet at all. Damn Governor Tierney. I'd wring his neck when I caught up with him, unless someone else had already done that job for me. The weather was miserable, cold winds by day, cold rain by night. The men who traveled with me were surly, Winter was coming early, but it wasn't the icy winds that were leaving me raw. It was my last night with Leah. I had never told anyone, not even the Komazar, what my mother's name was. Catherine. It was as though I had raised her from the dead. I had seen her again, heard her voice again, as I told Leah about her. Saying her name aloud, something tore inside of me. But then I couldn't stop telling Leah more, remembering how much my mother had loved me, the only person who had ever loved me. That wasn't something I had wanted to share with Leah, but in the dark, once I had said her name, it all poured out, right down to the color of her eyes. And my father's eyes. That memory stopped me. I hadn't told her everything. Leah, like a whisper on the wind. At first, I had thought that was all it was, the wind and long hours riding alone. When Leah had first told me her name in the tavern, it had reminded me of the hush I heard riding across the savannah. Leah through the canyons in the desert. Leah, the cry of a distant wolf. Leah, wheedling into my heart before I ever laid eyes on her. And then Leah, as I stood over her in the darkness of her room, my knife in hand. It was a whisper I finally couldn't ignore, though I had managed to choke it from my life from the moment I met the Komazar. The knowing had only brought me pain. I had used it the way Leah had. I had told the lady of the manor she was going to die a slow and horrible death, though I had seen no such thing. I was 8 years old, and angry that it was my own mother who was dying, and not the petty one of my half-brothers, a woman who had never shown me any kindness. That was when my first beating came. It was at the hands of my father, not the beggars. They only left scars atop the ones he had already laid deep. Which one was it, Caden? His name was one I would never give up, not even to Leah. But it would be my name on his lips as he lay dying. My name would be the one he uttered as he gasped his last breath, knowing he had been betrayed by his own son. It was a thought that had warmed me for years. Our plans. That moment had always been implicit in them. We rounded the pass and had started to make our descent into the valley when we saw them coming toward us. I stopped our procession until I was certain who they were. I sighed and signaled us forward again to meet them. We must never grow lazy. But the governor of Arliston had. There would be no neck to wring. He was dead. The squad of men heading our way bore the flags of Arliston, and the man leading them had to be the new governor, a sturdy man, but not young as challengers usually were. I didn't care. He was headed in the right direction, knowing his duty, and that was all that mattered. I could return to the sanctum now. I could return home to Leah. The last stray governor had been found.
Chapter 32 Rafe.
That door, Ulrich grumbled, pointing ahead. I'll be back in 2 hours. It won't take me that long to bathe, but my duties will take me that long. Sit tight until I come back for you. He stomped off, still angry that I had won a hot bath in a game of cards last night. He claimed he'd let me win because I stank, which may have been true. As much as I wanted an actual bath, my real purpose was to see more of the layout of the sanctum, and I knew that the bath chamber was closer to the tower where Leah stayed with Caden. while I had been given some liberties in my movement, traveling alone to a different part of the sanctum wasn't among them. I memorized the path we took, asking Ulrich's innocuous questions, trying to determine which hallways were the most frequently traveled and where they led. Ulrich's, even with his short temper, proved useful. I opened the door to the bath chamber, and there, as promised, was a tub filled with water. I dipped my hand in, lukewarm at best, but more than inviting after only being able to wash up with a basin of cold water. There was soap and a towel, too. Ulrich's must have been feeling generous. I threw my clothes off and shoved my head in first, scrubbing my face and scalp, then got in and soaked. But the water was rapidly cooling, so I washed and got out before it turned cold. I dried off and was only half-dressed when I felt hands on my bare back. I spun, and there was Leah, pushing me up against the wall. "What are you doing here?" I said. "You can't." She drew my face to hers and kissed me, warm and long, her fingers raking through my wet hair. I pulled away. "You have to leave. Someone might..." But then my mouth came down on hers again, hard and hungry, sending a far different message than the one I was trying to convey. My hands slid around her waist, traveled up her back, soaking in all the lost time and days that I had wanted to hold her. "No one saw me," she said between kisses. "Yet." "I heard Ulrich's tell you he'd be gone for 2 hours, and no one will check on me for at least that." My body molded to hers. I could taste the desperation in her kisses, and then she whispered about the distant hills of Venda she had seen, endless hills we could get lost in. "For a few days, if we're lucky," I said. "That's not enough. I want a lifetime with you." She faltered for a moment, brought back to our reality, then rested her cheek on my chest. "What are we going to do, Rafe?" she asked. "It's been 12 days, and only a matter of a dozen more before riders return with news of the king's good health." "Stop counting the days, Leah," I said. "You'll drive yourself mad." "I know," she whispered, and stepped back. Her eyes grazed my bare chest. "You should get dressed before you catch cold," she said. With her so close, I was anything but cold, but I grabbed my shirt and put it on. She helped me button it, and every brush of her fingers seared my skin. "How did you get out of your room?" I asked. "There's an abandoned passageway. It doesn't lead to much, mostly busy hallways, which makes it useless most of the time. But sometimes, opportunity presents itself." She didn't seem worried about how she'd get back to her room undetected, though I was. She put her finger to my lips and told me to stop, saying we had precious little time together, and she wasn't going to use it worrying about that, too. "I already told you I'm good at sneaking," she said. "I have years of experience at it." I barred the door and moved empty buckets from a cot to the floor so we could sit. We updated each other on what little we knew. She nestled in my arms, telling me about traveling through the countryside of Venda and how the people there were just like any others. People trying to survive. She said they were kind and curious and nothing like the council. I told her what I had learned about the pathways from Ulrich's, but I held back on some things I had been doing, particularly the weapons I had managed to hide. I had seen the fire in her eyes when she talked about sneaking one from the barrows in the sanctum. She had witnessed her brother's brutal death, and I couldn't blame her for wanting revenge. But I didn't want her retrieving a knife or sword before the timing was right. She pushed on my shoulders to make me lie back, and I pulled her with me, my caution crumbling. I wanted her more than life itself. She looked down at me and traced her finger along my jaw. "Prince Rafferty," she said curiously, as if still trying to grasp who I really was. Jackson is what they call me back in Dalbrek. But I'll always call you Rafe. Are you disappointed that I'm not a farmer? She smiled. You may learn to grow melons yet. Or maybe we'll grow other things, I said, pulling her close. And we kissed again and again. Leah, I finally whispered, trying to bring us both back to our senses. We have to be careful. She pressed her forehead to mine, silent, then settled back against my shoulder. And we talked, almost as we had on our last night together in Terravin. But this time, I told her the truth. My parents weren't dead. I told her what they were like, and a little bit about Dalbrek. Were they angry when I ran from the wedding? My father was furious. My mother was heartbroken, both for me and herself. She was eager to have a daughter. She shook her head. Rafe, I'm so... Shh, don't say it. You don't owe anyone an apology. And then I told her the rest, that it was never proposed to me as a real marriage, and that my father had even suggested I take a mistress after the wedding, if the bride didn't suit my tastes. A mistress? Well, isn't that romantic? She leaned up on one arm to look at me. What about you, Rafe? She said, more softly. What did you think when I didn't show up? I thought back to that morning, waiting in the cloister of the abbey along with the entire Dalbrek cabinet, pulling at my coat. We'd had to ride all night, delayed because of the weather, and I just wanted to get it over with. When the news came that you had left, I was surprised, I said. That was my first reaction. I couldn't quite figure out how it could happen. Two kingdoms' cabinets had worked out every detail. In my mind, it may as well have already been chiseled in stone. I couldn't understand how one girl could undo the plans of the most powerful men on the continent. Then, when I finally got past my shock, I was curious about you. You weren't angry? I grinned. Yes, I was, I conceded. I wouldn't admit it at the time, but I was furious too. She rolled her eyes. Ha! As if I didn't know. I suppose it was apparent when I got to Terravin. The minute you walked into that tavern, I knew you were trouble, Prince Rafferty. I wove my fingers through her hair and pulled her closer. As I did you, Princess Arabella. Her lips pressed to mine, and I wondered if there would ever be a day we didn't have to cut our time together short. But I was getting worried about Oryx. He'd been gone almost an hour, I guessed, and I didn't want to take a chance in case he returned early. When I pushed her away, she promised to leave in 5 more minutes. 5 minutes is hardly enough time to drink an ale, but we filled it with memories from our time in Terravin. I finally told her she had to go. I looked out the door first to make sure the hall was clear. She touched my cheek before she left and said, "Someday we'll go back to Terravin, won't we, Rafe?" "We will," I whispered, because that was what she needed to hear. But as the door shut behind her, I knew if we ever got out of here, I would never take her back to anywhere in Morrigan, including Terravin.
Chapter 33.
I tried to stop counting the days as Rafe had told me to, but each day that the Komazar took me out to a different quarter, I knew we had one less. Our outings were brief, just long enough to show me off to this elder or that quarter lord and those who gathered around, planting his version of hope among the superstitious. For a man who had little patience for lying, He sowed the myth of my arrival freely, like seed thrown by handfuls in the wind. The gods were blessing Venda. Strangely, an equilibrium settled in between us. It was like dancing with a hostile stranger. With each of our steps, he got what he wanted, the added devotion of the clans and hillfolk, and I got something I wanted, too, though I couldn't quite put a name to it. It was a strange pull in unexpected ways and times. The glint of the sun, a shadow, the cook chasing a loose chicken down the hallway, the smoke in the air, a sweetened cup of Thanis, the brisk chill of morning, a toothless smile, the resonance of Paviyama chanted back to me, the dark stripes of sky as I chanted eventide remembrances. They were all disconnected moments that added up to nothing, and yet they caught hold of me like fingers lacing into mine and drawing me forward. The advantage of having Caden gone was that I was left to my own devices at night. In his rush to make arrangements before he left, Caden had only told Aster to come and escort me to the bath chamber if I requested it, and help me with personal needs, but he hadn't defined what those needs might be. I assured her my nighttime request was one of those needs. It turned out she was happy to conspire with me. The sanctum was far warmer than the hovel she shared with her papa and cousins. I had asked her if she knew of a way to get to the catacombs without passing through the main hallway. Her eyes grew wide.
"You want to go to the ghoul caves?"
Apparently Eben and Finch weren't the only ones who called it that. Grizz was right. The little urchin knew every mouse trail in the sanctum, and there were many. In one of them, I had to get down on my hands and knees to crawl through. As we walked through another, I heard a distant roar.
"What's that?"
I whispered.
"We don't want to go that way," she said. "That tunnel leads to the bottom of the cliffs. Nothing there but the river, lots of wet rock, and bridge gears."
She led me down an opposite path, but I made note of the way. A path that led to the bridge, even though it was impossible to raise, was something I wanted to explore. We finally emerged into a wider cave-like tunnel, and the familiar sweet smell of oil and dusty air welcomed us. I thought at this hour it would be empty, but we heard footsteps. We hid in the shadows, and when the dark-robed men shuffled past, we followed a safe distance behind. I understood now why it was called ghoul caves. The walls weren't just made of broken ruins. Human bones and skulls lined the path, a thousand ancients holding up the sanctum, poised to whisper their secrets, ones Aster didn't want to hear. When she saw them and gasped, I clapped my hand over her mouth and nodded reassurance. "They can't hurt you," I said, though I wasn't so sure myself. Their empty socket stairs followed our steps. The narrow path led in a steep downward slope to an enormous room, one that bore the art and architecture of another time, and I guessed that it might date all the way back to the ancients. Deep in the ground, and perhaps sealed away for centuries, it was in remarkably good repair, and so were its contents. It wasn't just any room, but a room full of books that would make the royal scholar pale. It dwarfed all his libraries put together. At the far end, I saw the robed men sorting books into stacks and occasionally tossing one into a mountain of discards. Similar mountains were scattered throughout the room. Partially hidden from view was a wide, curved opening to another room beyond this one. Light poured out of it, bright and golden. I could see at least one figure inside hunched over a table writing on ledgers. This was an extensive, organized effort. Passing shadows flickered across the floor. There were others in that room, too. Those who sorted the books in the outside room occasionally took one into them. I desperately wanted to see what they were doing and what the books were that they studied.
"You want one?"
Aster whispered. "No," I said. "They might see us."
"Not me,"
she answered, showing off how low she was able to crouch. "And it ain't really stealing, because they burn those piles in the kitchen ovens." They burned them? I thought about the two books I had stolen from the scholar, both of their leather covers scorched with fire. Before I could stop her, Aster darted out, quiet as a shadow, and snatched a small book from the discards. When she ran back, her little chest heaved with excitement, and she proudly handed me her prize. It was bound differently from any books I had ever seen, razor straight and tight, and I didn't recognize the language. If it was some form of Vendan, it was even older than the Song of Venda I had translated. That's when I knew what they were doing. They were translating ancient languages, which explained why the services of skilled scholars were needed. I knew of three other kingdoms besides Morrigan that had a stable of scholars with any measurable skills. Gastineau, my mother's homeland, Turquoi Tra, which was home to mystic monks, and Dalbrek. Since they had discarded this book, I knew it wasn't important to them, but at least I knew now what their purpose here was. Deciphering a saved tomb of books, the lost books of the ancients. For a society where few of its people even read, this was an odd scholarly activity. My curiosity burned, but I fought the urge to confront and question them because it would reveal my nighttime wanderings and put Aster at risk as well. I tucked the book under my arm and nudged her toward the pathway of skulls, and we hurried back to my room. When we closed the door behind us, she giggled nervously at our adventure together. She asked if I could read the book to her, and I told her no. It was in a tongue I didn't understand.
"What about those?" she asked.
I looked to where she pointed. Lying neatly side by side on my bed were the books I had stolen from the royal scholar. I hadn't placed them there. I whirled, looking around the room for an intruder. There was no one. Who would enter my room and lay them out like that? "Aster," I said sternly, "are you playing games with me? Did you put them there before we left?" But with one look at her anxious expression, I knew it wasn't her. I shook my head so she wouldn't worry. "Never mind. I forgot that I left them there. Come on," I said as I gathered the books up and set them on the chest. "Let's get ready for bed." She had brought nothing but the clothes on her back, so I dug around for another of Caden's warm shirts. It fell to her ankles, and she hugged the soft fabric to her skin. When I brushed my hair, I saw her rub her short scruff dreamily as if imagining it long. "All that hair must keep your neck and shoulders nice and warm," she said. "I suppose it does, but I have something far prettier that might keep you warm. Would you like to see it?" She nodded enthusiastically, and I pulled the blue scarf Rena had given me from my saddlebag. I shook out the folds, and the silver beads jingled. I placed it over her head and wrapped the ends around her neck. "There," I said, "a beautiful vagabond princess. It's yours, Aster."
"Mine?"
She reached up and felt the fabric, touching the beads, her mouth open in wonder, and I felt a stab that such a small gesture meant so much to her. She deserved far more than what I could give her. We snuggled on my bed, and I recounted stories found in the Morrigan holy text, tales of how the lesser kingdoms grew from the chosen one, tales of love and sacrifice, honor and truth, all the stories that made me long for home. The candle burned low, and when I heard Aster's soft, restful snores, I whispered Rena's prayer. May the gods grant you a still heart, heavy eyes, and angels guarding your door.
And Herrick, true and faithful, brought Aldred to Morrigan, a husband worthy in the sight of the gods, and the remnant rejoiced. Morrigan, Book of Holy Text, Volume 3. Chapter 34.
It was already quite late, but while Aster slept with her scarf clutched in her hand, I sat down on the fur rug in the center of the room and looked at the books that had appeared on my bed. Somehow they had been laid in plain sight for me to find, as if I had forgotten them hidden beneath my mattress. In truth, I was so consumed with the business of staying alive, I almost had forgotten them. I had translated all of the Song of Venda on my way across the Camlan Tow, but I'd had time to translate only one brief passage of Vifure de Clara o Gaudrell. I pulled the small book from its sleeve and touched the embossed leather, fingering the burned corner. It had survived the centuries, a harrowing trip across the continent, and someone's attempt to destroy it. Gaudrell. I wondered who she was, besides a storyteller from a group of wanderers. The first passage had seemed to be a fanciful tale told to a child to distract her from her hunger, but even as I had translated it, I knew it had to be more. The royal scholar had hidden it away and even sent a bounty hunter to get it back. I grabbed the vagabond primer from my saddlebag to help me translate, then settled in, puzzling it out word by word, line by line, beginning with the first passage again. Once upon a time, my child, there was a princess no bigger than you. It was a story of a journey, hope, and a girl who commanded the sun, moon, and stars. When I went on to the next passage, it was again a child asking for a story, but this time for one about a great storm. It was strangely reminiscent of the Morrigan holy text. It was a storm, that's all I remember. A storm that wouldn't end. A great storm, she prompts. I sigh, yes, and pull her to my lap. Once upon a time, child, long, long ago, seven stars were flung from the sky, one to shake the mountains, one to churn the seas, one to choke the air, and four to test the hearts of men. Stars flung from the sky. Was it only a story? Or was Gaudrell actually one of the surviving ancients? A mere child herself when Aster hurtled a star to earth? That would explain why her story had errors. The holy text had been transcribed generation after generation by the best scholars in Morrigan, and it was clear that only one star brought on the devastation, not seven. But one or seven, it hardly mattered. For her, it was a storm that wouldn't end. A storm that made the ways of old meaningless. She spoke of sharp knives and iron wills, but I stopped cold when I got to the part about scavengers. Gaudrell and this child were always running from beasts that were as hungry as they were. Were they the mythical pachigos of Infernatare that the Vendans feared? Each page was a glimpse of another time, and together they were a chronicle of events from long ago. Gaudrell's history. Some passages seemed to be carefully phrased for a child's ears, but others were brutally raw. Aster stirred in her sleep, and I quickly skipped forward several pages. I would never get it all translated in one night. The next passage was a story about Gaudrell's father.
Tell me again, Amma, about the warmth, before.
The warmth came, child. From where, I don't know. My father commanded, and it was there.
Was your father a god?
Was he a god? It seemed so. He looked like a man, but he was strong beyond reason, knowledgeable beyond possible, fearless beyond mortal, powerful as a... Let me tell you the story, child, the story of my father. Once upon a time, there was a man as great as the gods. But even the great can tremble with fear. Even the great can fall. I sat back, staring at the page. It was too eerily close to the holy text that said, they thought themselves only a step lower than the gods. Two histories swirled before my eyes, mixing like blood and water. Which history came first? The Morrigan holy text, or the one I held in my hands? Aster rolled over, stretching, mumbling half asleep, and wondering if I was coming to bed. Soon, I whispered. I rushed forward through the pages again, searching for more answers.
Where did she go, Amma?
She is gone, my child. Stolen, like so many others.
But where?
I lift the child's chin. Her eyes are sunken with hunger. Come, let's go find food together. But the child grows older, her questions not so easily turned away.
She knew where to find food. We need her.
And that's why she's gone. Why they stole her. You have the gift within you too, my child. Listen. Watch. We'll find food, some grass, some grain.
Will she be back?
She is beyond the wall. She is dead to us now. No, she will not be back. My sister Venda is one of them now.
Sisters?
I translated the last passage again, certain I had made a mistake, but it was true. Gaudrell and Venda were sisters. Venda was once a vagabond, too. And then I read more. Let it be known, they stole her, my little one. She reached back for me, screaming, Amma. She is a young woman now, and this old woman couldn't stop them. Let it be known to the gods and generations, they stole from the remnant. Herrick, the thief, he stole my Morrigan, then sold her for a sack of grain to Aldred the Scavenger. I closed the book, my palms damp, stared at my lap, trying to understand, trying to explain it away, trying not to believe it. It wasn't just any child that Gaudrell told this history to. It was Morrigan. She was a girl not chosen by the gods, but stolen by a thief and sold to a scavenger. Herrick wasn't her father, as the holy text claimed. He was her abductor and seller. Aldred, the revered founding father of a kingdom, was little more than a scavenger who bought a bride. At least, according to this history, I wasn't sure what to believe. Only one thing felt certain in my heart. Three women were torn apart. Three women who were once family.
Chapter 35. Rafe.
Calantha and Oryx dragged me to the stables. I was to have another ride through their miserable city, the only advantage being that I could search for another way out, though it was looking more certain there were none. Vendan riders were swift, and the lost days burned in my head. I went through every military strategy Sven had ever drilled into me, but none of those strategies had ever included Leah and the risk to her. These thoughts were consuming me, so I didn't recognize him at first. He dumped dried patties into a bin near the stables. His clothes were dirty and torn. When I followed Calantha and Ulrich into the stable, my eyes had passed over him, focusing instead on my own horse in the first stall. One of the Chievdars had claimed him for his own. He was well cared for and groomed, but it goaded me that he would now serve Venda. Calantha and Ulrich were taking me out on the Commissar's orders. I saw him leaving with Leah as we arrived in the stable yard. I feared for her in the Commissar's company. "She'll be fine," Calantha said. I averted my gaze, saying I was only curious about the purpose of these rides throughout the city. "A campaign of sorts," she told me vaguely. "The Commissar wishes to share our newly arrived nobility with others." "I'm only a lowly emissary, not a noble." "No," she said. "You'll be anything the Commissar wishes you to be. And today, you're the Grand Lord Emissary of the Prince of Dalbrick." For a nation that despises royalty, he seems eager to flaunt it. "There are many ways to feed people." As we led our horses from the stable, the paddy clapper carted a load in front of the door, tripping and spilling it to its side. Ulrich cursed him for blocking our way.
"Ficatande idaro, bogeve enarjos vidaka."
The paddy clapper scrambled on the ground, trying to return the paddies as fast as he could to the cart. He stopped and looked up, cowering, spilling out apologies in Vendan. I squinted when I saw him, thinking I had to be mistaken. It was Jeb. He was filthy, with matted hair, and he stank. Jeb, a paddy clapper. It took every bit of my willpower not to reach down and embrace him. They had made it. At least Jeb had. I looked around the stable yard, hoping to see the others. Jeb vigorously shook his head as he apologized for his clumsiness. He briefly aimed his gaze just at me, shaking his head again. The others weren't here. Yet. Or did he mean they wouldn't be coming at all? "Bring some of those up to my room when you're done. North Sanctum Tower," I said. Calantha exchanged some quick words with Jeb.
"Mi ene urat selienda?"
Jeb shook his head and gestured with his fingers.
"Nay, mi aseten." "The fool doesn't understand your tongue," Ulrich growled. "And your room gets heated last, emissary. When the council is nice and warm, then maybe you'll get some."
Jeb nodded, throwing the last of the patties into the cart. North Tower. The fool understood perfectly, and now he knew where to find me. He wheeled the cart out of the way, and Ulrich pushed past us, his patience spent.
"I'll meet you there."
"Where is there?" I asked Calantha. She sighed as if bored. For someone so young, she was jaded beyond her years. As much as I had tried to pry information from her about her position at the sanctum, she was an icy wall when it came to details about herself.
"We are going to the Stonegate Quarter with a quick stop at Corpse Call," she said. "The Commissar thought you might find it entertaining."
I had been a soldier in the field for almost 4 years. I had seen a lot. Men stabbed, maimed, their skulls split wide.
I'd even seen men torn apart by wild animals, half-eaten. In the Camlanteau and on the battlefield, there were no delicate considerations for how a man died. I had learned to expect anything. But the bile rose in my throat when we topped the crest of Corpse Call, and I stifled the catch in my chest as I started to look away. Ulrich pushed on my shoulder.
"Better get a good look. The Commissar's going to ask you what you think of it."
I turned back. I looked steady and hard. Three heads on stakes. Flies buzzed on swollen tongues. Maggots roiled in eye sockets. A raven yanked stubbornly on something sinuous from a cheek, like it was a worm. But even through the decay, I could tell they were boys. They were once boys.
"The assassin took care of these three. Traitors they were."
Ulrich shrugged and walked back down the hillock. I turned to Calantha.
"Caden did this?"
"Overseeing executions is his duty as keep. The dressing up on stakes is done by soldiers. They'll stay there until the last flesh falls from the bone," she answered. "That's on the Commissar's orders."
I looked at her, her single pale eye glistening, a weakness to her shoulders that were usually rigid with cynicism.
"You don't approve," I said.
She shrugged.
"What I think doesn't matter."
I reached out and touched her arm before she could turn away. She flinched as if she thought I was going to strike her, and I stepped back.
"Who are you, Calantha?" I asked.
She shook her head. Her bored manner returned.
"I've been no one for a very long time."
Chapter 36.
It was a rare, cloudless morning of crisp blue sky. Fresh air was warmed with the fragrance of Thanis, for though its taste was sour, its scent was sweet. The brightness of the day helped chase away my exhaustion. As if I didn't have enough to think about, I couldn't get Gudrell's book out of my head. Through the late night hours, I woke again and again with the same thought. They were family. Morrigan was stolen and sold to a scavenger. Though it might be true that she had the gift and led a people to a new land, those she led were not a noble remnant chosen by the gods, but scavengers who preyed on others. They had preyed on Morrigan.
"You slept well?" the Commissar called over his shoulder.
I clicked my reins to catch up with him. My sham was to continue today in the canal quarter, at the washing grounds opposite the Jehendra.
"Your pretense warms me," I said. "You care not one whit how I slept."
"Except for the dark circles under your eyes. It makes you less appealing to the people. Pinch your cheeks. Maybe that will help."
I laughed. "Just when I think I couldn't hate you more, you prove me wrong."
"Come now, Jezalia. After I've shown you every kindness, most prisoners would be dead by now."
While I wouldn't call it kindness, his remarks to me had grown less biting, and I couldn't help but note he did something my father had never done in his own kingdom. He walked among those he ruled, both near and far. He didn't rule from a distance, but intimately and thoroughly. He knew his people. To an extent. Yesterday he had asked me what the claw and vine design on my shoulder was. I didn't mention the Song of Venda, and I hoped no one else would either, but I was sure that at least a few of those who had stared at it were digging it up from dusty memories of long-forgotten tales. "A mistake," I had told him simply. "A wedding kavah not properly applied."
It seems to have captured the fancy of many.
I'd shrugged it off. I'm sure it's as much a curiosity to them as I am. Something exotic from a faraway kingdom.
That you are. Wear one of your dresses tomorrow that shows it off properly,
he had ordered.
That dreary shirt is tedious.
And also warm. Only that was of little concern to him. Not to mention, the dresses weren't particularly suited for riding. Again, inconsequential in light of his greater plans. I had nodded, acknowledging his demand, but I wore my shirt and trousers again today. He hadn't seemed to notice. When he wasn't scrutinizing my every movement and word, I enjoyed my interactions with the people. They provided me with a different kind of warmth that I probably needed more. That part wasn't a sham. The welcome of the Murasi had spread to many clans. The moments of sharing Thanis, or stories, or a few sincere words gave me balance, if not a few hours of relief from the sanctum. My gift rarely came into play. A few times I was gripped with a sense of something large and dark descending. I sucked in a breath and looked upward, truly expecting to see a black clawed thing swooping down upon me, but there was nothing there. Only a feeling that I'd quickly shake off when I saw the Komazar smiling. He never missed an opportunity to turn it into something corrupt and shameful. He made me want to smother the gift instead of listen to it. It seemed impossible to nurture anything in his presence. We reached a narrow lane and dismounted, handing off the reins to guards who followed us.
"Is it this?"
he asked, tugging on Walther's baldric with his thumb.
"Is this what continues to make you so testy?"
I looked at the strap of leather across his chest that I had managed to block from my vision by some magic of will. Testy? By the gods, they had stolen it off my brother's dead body after they had massacred his entire company. Testy! I looked from the baldric into his cool black eyes. A smile swept through them as if he saw every burning thought in my mind. He shook his head, satisfied with my silent response.
You need to learn to let go of things, Leah. All things. Nevertheless.
He slipped his dagger from it, then lifted the baldric over his head and placed it over mine. His hands lingered on my back as he adjusted it.
Yours. As a reward. You've been proving yourself useful these past days.
I breathed with relief when he finally finished adjusting the baldric and removed his hands from my back. Your people already bend at your command, I said. What do you need me for? He reached up, and his hand gently glided over my cheek.
Fervor, Leah. Food supplies are shorter than ever. They'll need fervor to help them forget their hunger, their cold, their fear through this last long winter. That's not too much to ask, is it?
I looked at him uncertainly. Fervor was an odd word choice. It implied something more feverish than hope or determination.
I don't have words to stir fervor, Komazar. For now, just do what you've been doing all along. Smile, flutter your lashes as if spirits whisper to you. Later, I'll tell you the words to speak.
His hand slid to my shoulder, caressing it. Then I felt the fabric of my shirt pinching me as he gathered it up in his fist. He yanked suddenly, and I winced as the cloth tore free from my shoulder.
There now, he said. Your tedious shirt is taken care of.
His fingers brushed over my shoulder where the kava now lay exposed, and he leaned close so that his lips were hot against my ear.
The next time I tell you what to do, see that you do it.
We headed toward the washing grounds without another word.
I garnered stares for both my kavah and my flapping torn shirt. Fervor. That's not too much to ask, is it? He was making me a spectacle one way or another. I was so